Gallatin Valley is a great place to live. There are great opportunities here. One of them is to listen to your community radio, KGVM 95.9 FM, or go to the internet at kgvm.org. I am Dr. Arliss Woods, psychologist, chair of the Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association, along with co-host Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. Each week, we bring you guests covering a wide range of topics, most often focusing on mental health. However, any area affecting our health and happiness is covered as well. Dr. Suzanne will now present our guest and topic for this presentation of KGVM's Health and Happiness.
Welcome, everyone, and we're happy to have with us for this show one of the most prolific, prize-winning, and versatile authors and adventurers that I've run across. We have Stephen Trimble with us. And just to give you an idea of his many accomplishments, although we're going to speak about his book, The Mike File, and that's the center of our attention today, we'd like you to consider, Stephen, just telling us about the books you've written, a line or two each, and what prizes you've won.
Oh, you want me to list my prizes, huh?
I do.
I've been working as a writer and photographer ever since I was first out of college, working as a seasonal national park ranger. That's how I served my apprenticeship. I always wanted to tell stories and share my experiences in words and photographs. And that led to my career, which led to 25 books as either writer, editor, or photographer. Writing about the West, Native peoples of the West, our relationship with the land, and conservation issues trying to save that land. The Mike File is very different from all those other books. You know, it's a personal memoir, and we'll be talking mostly about that. But my main line of work has been books about the Grand Canyon and the Great Basin Desert and the national parks of the Colorado Plateau and how our kids learn to be connected to nature and how we make our decisions about the places we love. And I've tried to make each of those books as good as I possibly can, so some of them indeed have won awards, and I'm delighted by those awards. But mostly, as a working writer and photographer, I love the process. I love working and creating the words and stories and pictures that come together as books that I can share with readers.
And I assume that you don't get these wonderful photographs of way out there, far away places, deep in deserts or canyons or mountaintops, without going there personally. So you've had many journeys, is that correct, Michael? Stephen?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. No, absolutely. The great joy for me is being out and soaking up the place or interviewing the people that I'm writing about. I actually just came back from 5 days wandering around in the middle of nowhere, truly the middle of nowhere, where I see only occasional other vehicles in Nevada, where I'm working on an update of my book about the Great Basin Desert, the Sagebrush Ocean, for a 35th anniversary edition. That's an astonishing number. The book was originally published in 1989, and I just glory in being out there. I feel like I have my own personal wilderness, because so few people go to those obscure Great Basin valleys in the middle of Nevada.
That's amazing. And so when you trek out there, what kind of gear do you take along? How do you manage that out in the middle of absolutely nowhere?
Nothing special. I'm actually pretty casual about it. For many years, I had a pickup and slept in the back of the truck. These days I have a Subaru and sleep in the back of the Subaru. I go alone. No one else wants to do quite what I'm doing, where I'm stopping every little half mile or mile to poke around and take pictures and soak up the place whenever I see something interesting. And, you know, it's just basic camping equipment. I'm not a particularly technically oriented photographer. I always have cameras that I trust and can take pictures sharp enough for reproduction in books. But as a photographer, it's really the moment of connection with the landscape when I push the shutter that I'm excited about, rather than tinkering in the old days in the darkroom or today on my computer screen. You know, I know how to do that. I have to do that. But my joy is in capturing the image in initially when I'm out in the world. The decisive moment, as the great photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson called it.
Excellent. Well, we're just so impressed that you not only talk about it, you actually go and do it and live it. And of course, I guess that's your favorite part about it, but we really are impressed by that work. And thank you for kind of reviewing for us some of those mountaintops you've achieved. We were wondering, too, if you could talk to us a little bit about today's discussion, The Mike File. It's a story of grief and hope, it says on the front of your book. And so we know that this is very deep within you and the family. We also had a brother who had disabilities, and we've worked with that his whole life. So we understand from our perspective somewhat of what's happened, but how would you like to begin your talk about The Mike File, Stephen?
Well, Suzanne, I can tell you how I came to write the book. My mom, Isabel, grew up in Montana as one of two Jewish families in Livingston. And so, as you know, I was up in your country a month or so ago doing readings from the Mike File in Livingston and Bozeman and Butte, where my mom was born. And so it was really a thrill for me to come back and share the book in those communities where it all began so long ago. So my mom was born in Butte to a big extended clan of Jewish shopkeepers, and that clan sent her dad out to Livingston to open the family store there, where she grew up and wanted to get out of that small town and go have adventures in the big world. And so her mom pushed her into a marriage that was a bad choice to a man that took her to Denver, where he had grown up, and where my brother Mike was born. And my mom was married only 1 year to that man, who turned out to be an abusive man. And she left that marriage with my brother, and 5 years later married my father, and then I came along. So I grew up as a little kid with this big brother who was 8 years older than me. And he was the apple of my eye, to coin a phrase. You know, I adored him as all little kids adore their big brother. Mike was slow to learn. He was diagnosed as mildly retarded, the word that we used in those days, as a kid. But then as he hit adolescence, he disappeared into just volatility and rage and became so angry and so dangerous, really, to our family. He was a big kid that my parents began to think, you know, they simply couldn't handle having him at home. And so they had him diagnosed, evaluated, and he was diagnosed at 14 as someone with schizophrenia, which was probably the wrong diagnosis, but he was definitely a danger to our family. And the courts committed him to the Colorado State Hospital, and he left home and he never lived at home again. And Mike, you know, just to compress the story, Mike spent 10 years in the state hospital system, and another 10 years living in halfway houses in Denver, and died in his 30s, many, many, many years ago. And that, you know, that's a tragic story. You can imagine how my mother felt about that story. She did not want to talk about Mike, did not want to tell these stories, did not want to look back. You know, she was carrying a lot of guilt and a lot of shame and a lot of sadness and grief. And so that was a story we didn't talk about. And all these years later, after both of my parents had died, long after Mike had died, I had those stories kind of at the fringes of my own memories. And over the years, my friends and colleagues in my writing group would periodically say, "Steve, you know, you've got this story that's just full of emotion as a writer. This is the best material you have. You ought to do something with it." And of course, as a person and a member of my family, I felt that I'd never really done any justice at all to Mike and his memory. So about a year after my dad died in 2011, I decided that I would begin to explore Mike's story. And that's really the genesis of this little book that became the Mike File.
Beautifully said, Stephen. And we feel your grief in reading the book. It's just so much lost when we couldn't recover Mike. And I just wanted to point out here as we go into this discussion, there's a very powerful book called The Mike File. It's a small, powerful book. And what prize did you win for this book, Stephen?
I won the prize for the last year, the Mental Health Awareness Book of the Year from an indie book organization.
And congratulations on that, and it's well-deserved and well-earned. And
thank you.
Part of me just feels that I want to comfort your mother, because as Mike became violent, she didn't really have an option, because he really became a danger for the family. And yet what she turned to, the system, was not what we would ever want. Could you talk a little bit about that, Stephen?
Sure. You know, this is 1957, so long ago. And so child psychology, as you two, I'm surely know this history, child psychology barely existed. There was no family therapy. There was no National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. There was nowhere for my parents to turn for help. And so it was just such a different time. And so they felt they had no choice but to turn to the courts, to the system, capital T, capital S. And those were the days when state hospitals were grim, grim places. You know, Mike arrived at the Colorado State Hospital. He was old enough to be put on a ward with men of all ages. I'm sure some of those guys were, you know, really severely mentally ill who had been there for decades. Mike barely missed the time of lobotomies and, you know, cooling people down to almost hypothermic levels, thinking that that would help them, and massive electroshock. He arrived there at the beginning of the years when the first drugs were used to calm people down, drugs like Thorazine that, you know, would almost turn the residents into zombies, all connected to this almost certain misdiagnosis of schizophrenia. You know, in those days, a third of the psychiatric diagnoses were schizophrenia. It was just a sort of a garbage pail diagnosis to label anyone who was having severe mental illness symptoms. And Mike was stuck there with 6,000 other people. That's how many people were in the state hospital at that point. And the average stay in those days in the state hospital was 13 years. You know, very different from what we understand is therapeutic for folks now. And so my parents were told when Mike first went to the state hospital to not even visit him, that it just would upset him. They did not believe that, and they continued to visit once a month or so. But every time my mom would cry all the way back to Denver, you know, the 100 plus miles from the state hospital in Pueblo, Colorado, back to our home in Denver. And so it was the only choice they had, but it was not a very good choice.
You know, you touched so many ideas, the thoughts that you know, you bring up in my studies in psychology and personal experiences. As Suzanne mentioned, I have a brother older than I who was diagnosed early as being mentally retarded and never had the opportunity to go to organized school. I had seizures in the beginning. Was sent to, we were in Oklahoma at the time, to Enid State School for the Mentally Retarded, as they called it at the time. Mm-hmm. And the structure wasn't there. Over the years, Suzanne and I worked with my mom as she was a widow early in life, and he lived with her to get him into a facility, an independent living facility, because he really had far more capabilities than anyone was saying that he did. It was called Rainbow Hills in Oklahoma City, and I'll let Suzanne talk a little bit about that.
We were just desperate, like I'm sure your parents were, but we had some better options because Klaus was very unhappy at home. There was just nothing for him there, and it was just very depressing, and he just looked depressed. And so we found out about the United Cerebral Palsy's effort to provide a facility for people with disabilities. It was supposed to be for people of normal intellect, so we had to make a special plea for Klaus and explain that he was like a little old lady in many ways because he'd lived with Grandmother Anna and he could clean, mop, do whatever. He was very able. He also has a phenomenal memory and a good sense of humor when he's not depressed. And one family member actually said about him, well, he wouldn't know how to turn the light off if he needed to. It just felt like it was a terrible idea for him to try independent living. However, we decided, and the United Cerebral Palsy Group decided to give him the chance. And we brought him up to Oklahoma City on a very icy winter's night. And he was in his little apartment, which we had furnished and filled up the fridge. And he could go out of his door and go down a hallway. And there were other people there. And we didn't know if he was going to be very sad, frightened, but he really wanted to try. And so it got very icy there. We couldn't get back to see him for a couple of days. We called, and he was absolutely thrilled. He said, and we hadn't realized this, I've never had my own key before. And he never once didn't love where he was. And so we want to thank United Cerebral Palsy in Rainbow Hill. He stayed there many years and had a best friend, Carl Steele, who would drive, and they went on trips together. They both had jobs at a workshop. And so we had an experience. We know how difficult it is to find a good spot. We feel so fortunate that we did. Today, Klaus is in a medical facility, a nursing home. He's how old now?
87 almost.
87, doing very well. He called yesterday and woke us up. So we just want to say, Stephen, we've been through some of those difficult decisions like your mother made, and we're so sorry she had to feel so badly because she tried everything in her power and within her realm to try to help Michael.
Yeah, that's so true. And that was a lovely story to hear in terms of having a pretty positive and happy ending for your brother. I actually end the book imagining a better life for Mike, imagining the best possible scenario, the best case scenario. And it's not the scenario that happened, but the one thing I did not experience with my brother was that back and forth, calls in the middle of the night. You know, he had both this disability of being a slow learner and whatever mental illness he may have had. Maybe he was bipolar, maybe he had bipolar disorder, maybe he was autistic, maybe he simply had depression and learning disabilities. You know, it's hard to know now. All the hospital records were destroyed. But he could have had a very different life and lived in some kind of community residential group home, a little bit like the kinds of things you're describing. But he wasn't able to do that. When he was released from the hospital in the 60s, when state hospitals across the country were mainstreaming patients back to their communities, you know, it was an outgrowth of President Kennedy's vision of community health centers that was a great idea, but then was drastically underfunded after the loss of President Kennedy and eventually led to the epidemic of homelessness. But Mike was one of those people that was mainstreamed back from the hospital to Denver, where he lived in boarding houses, state-supervised boarding houses. And he rather quickly cut off contact with our family. It was simply too upsetting. I think he was probably too embittered and angry about having been banished from the family, although I didn't understand that at the time. You know, I was in high school when he was released from the hospital. And, you know, I was a kid. I was a teenager I was self-involved. I was a little scared of Mike, this unpredictable big guy. You know, I keep referring to him as big. He was over 6 feet tall. And my parents and I are all pretty short people. None of us got over 5'8". So Mike towered over us in our home. And when Mike cut off contact, I'm sure I was basically relieved as a 16-year-old. And he lived for another 10 years in those boarding houses with very little peripheral contact with us, just exchanging holiday cards. We did not see him. And so I never experienced that relationship so many people have with their family members who are struggling in some way, where you get calls in the middle of the night, sometimes from the police, where you're trying to figure out the best placement for them. You know, it's an ongoing source of just struggle and sadness. And for us, Mike was just way out there at the edges of our lives. And I'm sure my mom thought about him far more than I did, but it was a really different experience.
I know with your research and personal experience, you have developed ideas about what we really need to do. I know I've developed some over time, and we've had people on the radio program, including Glenn Close, the actress, who has a nephew locally that has had extreme mental health issues and bad experiences with the systems. We have a government here in the state that had billions of dollars, at least I think 1 to 2 billion, surplus, and they are at least showing some effort in trying to improve things. I don't think nearly enough, and perhaps not even in the right method, but locally we've had a situation where people had to, the police would have to drive a person with a mental health crisis miles and miles to other facilities because there's not any that was properly staffed or available locally. So what I'm asking, what are some of your ideas you've come up with over these years?
Well, you know, obviously I'm not an expert in any way. I only know what I learned in researching the book. But what I learned from talking to lots of mental health providers in Denver, especially in Colorado, where the story takes place, led me to think, okay, here's what we could do. And, you know, there are a couple of writers who write a lot about mental illness, Robert Whitaker and E. Fuller Torrey, whose books I'm sure you know as well, who tend to be at odds with each other, but have really, really good ideas. And so I kind of put all of that together and imagined that when Mike came back to Denver, he could have lived in a well-funded group home with a bunch of, you know, with a small number of cohorts who would be his friends in his community, with a consistent staff. And, you know, this whole notion that I'm going to describe would cost the United States far less than what we do now, which leads to so many people on the streets or in prison who could be living much, much fuller lives if we did this right. So if we funded, you know, with federal money coming through a single agency in each state and community, in an organized way that kept the money flowing and didn't disperse it into random programs, you could have that small group home with a team of people keeping track of each person, keeping track of Mike, where he would have access to help, where he would have access to a bed in a hospital if he needed one, if he had a psychotic break at some point. You know, there's so few beds now, way fewer than we need. You know, a social worker, a psychiatrist, a community health contact in the neighborhood, one of the kinds of clubhouses that have become a movement in the mental health system, where the people who are struggling with their own mental health issues actually run the clubhouse, where they can spend time during the day, where Mike might have the job of keeping track of the record collection, the CD collection, the music collection. I ran into a clubhouse like that in Pueblo and spent a day with a couple of men who had diagnoses and who were, that was their lifeline, that was their life, running therapy groups themselves and keeping the place clean and being on the board of directors and giving their life a purpose. All of that worked really well for these folks. And Mike could have stayed in touch with our family if he had that kind of stability. So I'm a little more precise and a little more clear in the book than I'm being in our interview, because I have all the details down pat in the book. And yeah. I'm sounding a little vague right now, but I think you get the idea that
not
there
at
really
all
was
vague.
A good alternative.
No. I think, you know, we do have some facilities, and we've had them on this radio show here in Montana, and it just sounded so wonderful. They make sure they have jobs, they provide the kind of counseling access you've mentioned, they check on them daily, and we were so pleased to hear about those programs until we found out there's a waiting list of 4,000 or more people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the problem.
And so you have to wait years to get in, because once a person goes in, they will be there for a lifetime. Like Clois was in the United Cerebral Palsy Facility for most of his life after we were able to find that place. So we just need a lot more help with this. And I think your book about Mike really underlines that we don't have much choice if we're going to be human and humane. We've got to really step out and work on this.
And as one of the social workers I interviewed in Denver said, the mentally ill don't have much of a lobby when it comes to handing out money. You know, they're fighting for every dollar with big corporations and the fossil fuel lobby and big pharma. And, you know, it's quite different if you're there to speak for the mentally ill, for whom there's still a lot of stigma and shame. You know, we're more open now than we used to be, but that stigma and that shame is still there and makes things even more difficult.
That hits home with a situation I ran into years ago working with the psychology organizations. I did some lobbying in the state of Oklahoma, and nationally we'd go to the American Psychological Association meetings. And one story which illustrates what you're saying in one way is that when it happens to someone personally, like a senator or representative, all of a sudden, in many cases, it changes. There was a senator, I think it was probably New Mexico, I'm not sure, I forget, whose daughter suddenly developed a mental illness, and was chronic. And all of a sudden, this person who was quite conservative went from being the conservative with money for the mental health movement to be very, very liberal, and was able to progress to getting some national legislation passed that at the time helped a great deal in making, I think, insurance money available to pay for therapy and so forth. But I do know that a number of our politicians must have, I mean, they have to have a mental illness in their family. And you would think they'd be more sensitive to that, but it's not a priority. It's like the person you interviewed said, there's just really no good lobby for them for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, all of us have friends and family who are experiencing some mental illness. You know, 1 out of 5 Americans of all ages are experiencing some mental illness right now as we speak. And more than half of them receive no treatment. You know, it's a crisis that we just have simply not dealt with. And you're so right, Arliss. If someone has someone really close to them and someone with the power of a senator, they can make change. They can make things happen. It's we call it in my family legislation by anecdote.
You know, yeah.
That senator can tell the story of their family and the other senators kind of go along. And I wish that would happen more and more with the kinds of things that need change.
You know we have that same problem here in Montana. In a survey of the state by Bozeman Health, the hospital here, they found that 1 out of 5 people said their leading medical difficulty, we're not talking cancer, diabetes, whatever, it was mental health needs.
And substance abuse, yeah, altogether. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that, when Glenn Close was on the show with her sister, they pointed out that 1 out of 4 was more likely from some of their research. And so what we're seeing is this is a problem that truly, I would say, affects each of us.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And, you know, the subtitle of the Mike File is, as you said, a story of grief and hope. You know, there's plenty of grief. We haven't talked about Mike's death, which was really tragic and almost horrific. He died in one of those boarding houses, probably during a seizure. He had developed seizures along the way and wasn't discovered for several days. And then the media in Denver picked up on his death as an expose of these poorly supervised state-supported boarding homes and plastered Mike's death on the front page. And that's how my mom found out about the loss of her son. And as you can imagine, that accentuated her grief unbelievably and made it even less likely that she would talk about Mike for the rest of her life. So there, you know, as I said, there was plenty of grief in the story. Where was the hope? And I eventually decided that the hope was simply being more open, telling these stories, recognizing people, seeing people. You know, I think the book that I've written is very much about my standing up in the world and saying, I see you, Mike. I recognize that I had a brother who was more than a diagnosis. It was a fully blown human being that I never paid enough attention to. And I think if all of us were more open and said to the world, I see you, when we see a homeless person on the street just making eye contact and rather than looking away, with people in our family who struggle with mental health, paying a little more attention to them, just recognizing their struggles. I think all of that would take away a bit of the shame that might allow us to take more effective action. I think there's some hope in there.
We have a local organization, HRDC, that helps with this kind of problem. And they told us a story on the show about a man whose mental illness and substance abuse had kind of overtaken his life, to the point where he was just totally down and out, didn't have his ID anymore, his veteran, social security, anything, all lost, could hardly tell you who he was. And they brought him in and they helped him rehab and they helped him recover from the medication abuse he'd been experiencing. And they even were able, they've built some tiny houses, and they were able to allow him to move into one of the first tiny houses. And as they went through this process, they found out who he is. He was an artist that had been beloved for many years. They would paint the murals on the front, the storefronts, downtown Bozeman. He would paint mountaintops, you know, all sorts of beautiful things all across downtown or wherever. He was a wonderful artist, and he got to get back to himself and practice his art via this helping unit. So I guess what you're saying and what we're saying is when we help support groups like United Cerebral Palsy or HRDC or the Help Center that helps with 24-hour crises.
Or NAMI.
NAMI. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then what we're doing is all for Mike and Clois and your mom, who would be so pleased to see some of these things coming about. And yet again, we've got 4,000 on the waiting list.
Mm-hmm. We just need to have these conversations more openly. You know, I wish President Biden would be more open in talking about Hunter Biden's addiction, you know, the opioid use and other drugs that he was addicted to is a horrific problem in America. And, you know, the president is wonderfully emotionally supportive of his son, but that's the biggest and bulliest pulpit in the world. And if the president was spending more time talking really openly about the path that his son took and the addiction that has, you know, destroyed his life for years, I think that would help immensely in understanding what happened with Hunter Biden and helping lots and lots of other families be more open about their needs, and maybe even leading to some of that legislation by anecdote I talked about, maybe leading to better treatment and legal support for people in need.
I know there's some hope locally. For the past few years, there have been a group of people talking and lobbying and getting angry about the fact that the local health system didn't provide any inpatient or very little effort at having inpatient beds available for acutely mentally ill people who come into the emergency room. And there's been resistance, as I think everybody would agree, in the health system locally for a long period of time, to doing that for who knows what reason. It's the stigma, it's not a priority, we have other things to take care of. This radio show has had a number of people talking about that. There have been newspaper articles. Glenn Clois has lobbied locally. There have been, I know people that came on a radio show that has had some very tragic stories about their sons and daughters who went through amazingly awful crises, leading even to suicide and death in other ways, the addictions and so forth. And we're seeing a glimmer of hope. There appears to be the Bozeman Health System has gotten plans on the drawing board for I think 12, 15-bed inpatient facility, maybe it's 20 beds, I hope, locally that can keep the police from trying to drive people to Helena, to Billings, with and their sin and their crime is that they are having a mental crisis. So maybe there's a glimmer of hope locally that this will finally happen, and we're happy to have been able to air some of the concerns on the radio.
Yeah, that's good. We need more than 20 beds, of course. Yeah. So I have a question for you. I have a question for you. One of the notes I have when I do readings, I quote Mental Health America, that every year ranks states with the highest percentage of mental illness and the lowest access to care. And the West does the worst.
Yes.
Our home territory, you know, Utah, Wyoming, Idaho, Arizona, Oregon, they're all down the near the bottom of the list.
Absolutely.
Montana does better at about 21. But why do you think the West does so much more poorly than say, New England or Wisconsin?
That's been discussed over and over. People come up with varying ideas. One of them is there's a great, like in Montana, this crazy, fierce independence. I don't want anybody looking over my shoulder. I can make my own decisions. The government is too big. They tell me what to do. There's kind of an anger about that. And within that, unfortunately, there appears to be a lot of misinformation, distortions, failure to look at research, failure to look at facts. It's like data do not mean anything. It's what I believe, what my family has told me. One psychologist I know said that a lot of people in Montana like to think they have to cowboy up, grit their teeth, and bear it, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure what the had to factor analyze all that I just said, what the idea is there, but we also see that in kind of the anti-vax movement in some other areas. Everything has to be local, and even if the local group is crazy, they still want to stay grouped together with false ideas in order to push some agenda. But I don't think I've answered your question clearly, because I don't know what the answer is. I do know that Montana moved, I think, either first or second in suicide. And so that's not a distinction anybody would want to have.
That's so interesting. It's the cowboy myth, and that explains a lot of our politics as well, of course. My wife and I have been watching the precursors to the Yellowstone series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like it's almost a caricature, a satire of old-fashioned Westerns.
Is that 1889, that one?
Yeah, 1883 and 1923.
Yeah, 1923, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the 19. And they're fun to watch, but I think they're reinforcing a lot of those not very useful values that you described, Darlene.
Well, Stephen, I want to say your words about Joe Biden, I couldn't agree more that it would be so touching and so helpful to hear about their journey. And now you've made me think we definitely need to invite Joe Biden or Dr. Biden to be on this radio show.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And continue this discussion, because we've had people on who feel that everything from the altitude, we sit at 5,200 feet right now, to all different kinds of causes, but part of it might be that 4,000-person waiting list to get services.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I actually sent a copy of the mic file to Dr. Jill Biden.
Oh.
And because I sent it to her at her community college address where she teaches.
Yes.
And suggested that it might be a good book to use in her classroom. And I did get a one-line thank you back. So the book reached her, or at least reached an assistant. But I didn't get anything beyond that. Every time I get any idea at all of some connection to someone who might promote the book, I send them a copy, as all writers do. But I think Dr. Biden would be a great guest for you. You never know. You never know. Extend the invitation.
And also, I was pleased to know that John Fetterman out of Pennsylvania is a very unique individual, was
yes.
Had a bout of clinical depression, and also I think had a cardiovascular accident and stroke. And that, I think, in some ways helps, although those for some reason who are resistant to even talking about mental illness, I think, criticized him for this, that, and the other. And so we always have the naysayers, but I think the fact is that he was able to go through that, is back in action and working in the Senate. It could be helpful.
Very open about it as well, yeah.
Yeah, there was a very interesting article, I think maybe in the New York Times, talking about his journey and emphasizing his family and his wife and their reactions to it all. I'd recommend reading that, especially.
That sounds very excellent. You know, this discussion needs to continue, but while we have you, I just wanted to take a minute to ask about some of your other topics, Stephen.
Sure.
I have in front of me your article about the atomic bomb and Oppenheimer, which is, of course, a big topic recently. How did you come about this awareness of this whole situation? Was it going through the deserts and seeing where these bombs were actually dropped? Or how did you come to write this article? Perhaps you could describe for the audience briefly what's your thought in the article.
Sure. That's an op-ed that I published in the Los Angeles Times this summer. And it came kind of, the idea came fully blown to me when I walked out of the theater after seeing Oppenheimer. And I thought, oh my God, you know, the director, Christopher Nolan, had talked about, in every interview, he talked about Oppenheimer being the father of the atomic bomb and maybe the most important person who ever lived. But as I left the theater, I thought, well, if he's the father of the atomic bomb, he's also the father of the Anthropocene. That was really the genesis of that piece. You know, the Anthropocene is this new geologic epoch that we now live in, that the geologists have defined as the first geologic time period defined by the effect of humans on the planet. And I've been very interested in that. I've done a little bit of research in preparation for writing essays and had read a lot about the Anthropocene. And it turns out that geologists define their markers between time periods by finding things in the rocks they can actually see. And they've agreed that the beginning of the Anthropocene that shifts us into this new time period was when we could first see nuclear fallout worldwide in the stratigraphy, in the layers of rocks. And they actually have dated that moment to just after World War II, when we started doing a lot of nuclear testing, and have decided that the Anthropocene began in 1950, which happens to be the year I was born. So I've played around with that in essays. You know, I am the Anthropocene. I began my life at the same moment that the Anthropocene began. And I thought, okay, if Oppenheimer is the father of the atomic bomb, maybe he is the most important person who ever lived, because in some ways he began an entirely new geologic time period. And so I wrote an op-ed playing with those ideas.
Very well written.
Thank you. I have
a special interest in that because of something that happened to me when I was just a little child. We lived in St. George, Utah.
Mm.
And my parents got me up. This happened two or three times in the very early hours, black dark, and drove to the top of a mesa. And we were told through the press that we would hear a large plane coming overhead that would go in. You could see a broad valley in the moonlight, and you're up above on a mesa looking down, and you hear the huge plane rumbling over just above your head, and you're told to turn your back to the valley and close your eyes. And then there's a bright flash, so much brighter than day that if you don't have your eyes closed, you could have severe eye damage or blindness. So you stand there with your eyes closed and you're told to count 1001, 1003, etc. And you can then turn around, and I was that child who witnessed those bombs falling in the valley as a child. And what they didn't tell us then was they waited every time until the wind was in our direction. We were actually called the downwind people.
Mm-hmm.
And the devastation that occurred, the whole herds of sheep that died, the school principal that died, the many children that were born with severe defects of all kinds.
And they wanted that wind change because at the other side...
The reason they waited till it was downwind, the other direction was a huge metropolis center, Las Vegas, Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to avoid irradiating that group. And they
what an
didn't
amazing experience.
Tell us ever till many years later. It was all... There's a big Life magazine article with pictures of the special ed classrooms that had to be started. And that principal of mine wore a little badge on his lapel that was supposed to show if there were any radioactive, you know, things going on in the air, which was totally ineffectual. And he succumbed to the cancers that so many got from that situation. So I really read your article with interest that it wasn't, you know, there were a lot more victims than will be.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's an amazing experience and an amazing story, Suzanne. I've worked on a book a number of years ago with a colleague. I was partnering with a writer in Nevada, Ann Ronald, for a book on the state of Nevada called Earth Tones. For that book, I was the photographer, and I spent a day taking a tour of the Nevada test site that I was able, I think, I'm not sure who can actually take those tours. I signed up because I had this book project and was allowed to go out with a guide, but it was a very eerie experience to be out on the test site where they actually dropped the bombs and, you know, see the artificial villages that had been blasted to pieces and hear the stories of those multiple nuclear tests with still big craters. And I wore one of those little radioactivity monitors during the day that I had to turn in at the end of the day and make sure that I had not exceeded any limits. I don't think it's a terribly dangerous place now, but it was a spooky day and a spooky experience.
By all means, yes. Mm.
And not nearly as intense or dangerous as what you experienced. There's a powerful book by a photographer named Carol Gallagher called America Ground Zero that documents the downwinders, and there are a lot of photographs of folks in St. George and other areas around southwest Utah there whose families have been devastated by cancer over generations.
Yeah.
Very, very strong photographs.
Yeah, my father died of it as well.
Mm.
You know, there's so many topics upon which you gave the world great information. Talk a little bit about your concerns about ecology and the environment.
Well, that's a big question.
And I'm sorry, we don't have too much longer, but maybe you could highlight for us.
Sure. Well, I grew up with a dad. My father was a U.S. Geological Survey geologist whose whole professional life was committed to understanding the land, understanding the history of the land. And my dad was a Westerner. He grew up in Washington State. And I spent my childhood on vacations, you know, crisscrossing the West with my dad, basically teaching me that the view out the window had content, that it would be endlessly fascinating to understand that content, you know, how did the land form? What is the history of people coming to the land? What's the natural history? And I ended up with an attitude toward park rangers that they were kind of like rock stars. And great, to my great delight, I became a seasonal park ranger after college, after a general liberal arts degree, with lots of background in biology and ecology. And this back in the 70s, right after the first Earth Day. So I was really set up to be environmentally aware, and fell in love with my pieces of the West, especially the Colorado Plateau, the Red Rock Country around the Four Corners. And so as a writer and photographer with all of those values of the late 60s and early 70s, I became a lifelong conservationist and someone who felt like I could make a difference by giving money to environmental organizations and donating photographs to environmental organizations and writing letters to the editor and letters to federal agencies. And so I've been on the boards of a number of environmental organizations, currently Grand Staircase Escalante Partners, protecting the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument from unnecessary development. It really is a big part of my life. And I can't go too many months before I start to think, I need to write an op-ed. I'm not doing my job. I need to submit a piece to somewhere, making an argument for something in need, one of our crises. There's always a crisis. There are endless attacks on wild country. We have to win over and over again. We only lose once. And so we have to, I keep recycling the same arguments about protecting a particular landscape from unnecessary development that I've been writing ever since I was in college. It's really kind of stunning, but you gotta keep up the fight. That there's a lot of hope in taking action, and that's something that is really a strong thread through all of my work.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. We've just got a couple of minutes left. Could you quickly tell us how people in the listening audience could get a copy of your books, or especially the mic file?
It's widely available. I encourage folks to just simply order the book from your local bookstore. You know, if the Country Bookshelf or other bookstores in Bozeman aren't carrying it, ask them to order the book for you, and that's always good for me. They might order an extra copy to have on the shelf. You can certainly also go online. I encourage you not necessarily to go to Amazon, but to somewhat less corporate place. If you go to my website, stephentrimble.net, you'll find several links to some of the independent bookseller organizations that allow you to order online without going through Amazon. But Amazon's certainly convenient, and I order through Amazon myself. But supporting your local independent bookstore is absolutely the best way to do it.
We and couldn't agree more.
You can do that for any of my books or for the mic file.
This has been an amazing discussion today. We treasure what you said, and it's so helpful to the community, to our existence, the mental health movement. And please, audience, look up these books and buy them. And hopefully you'll become involved as well in the ecological movement as well as the mental health movement. We thank everybody for listening to KGVM. Please go to the website, kgvm.org. Go to the health and happiness section and look up past programs and current programs that you're interested in. Thank you again, and we will see you later.